usually reserved for attending the school board. She ran a comb through her hair, trying not to meet her own eye in the mirror. She didn't want to admit, even to herself, that she was afraid. She didn't want to face what she was afraid of. She'd found some things in the glove box of her car, things she couldn't explain, and she wasn't sure she wanted the explanation. She'd taken everything and hidden it, stupidly, childishly, under her bed.
"Are you ready?"
Sean was calling to her from downstairs. She took a deep breath, forcing herself to look at her own reflection, at her pale, clean face, her eyes clear as grey glass. "I'm ready," she said to herself. Helen sat in the back seat of Sean's car, Patrick riding up front next to his son. Nobody spoke, but she could tell by the way her husband kept touching his palm to his wrist that he was anxious. He would be hurting, of course. All this, these deaths in the river, raised painful memories for him and his father. As they crossed the first bridge, Helen glanced down at the greenish water and tried not to think of her, held down, fighting for her life. The cat. She was thinking of the cat.
Josh. I had a fight with Mum before we left for the funeral. I came downstairs and she was there in the hallway, putting on lipstick in the mirror. She was wearing a red top. I said, "You can't wear that to a funeral. It's disrespectful." She just gave a kind of funny laugh and went into the kitchen and carried on as though I hadn't said anything at all. I wasn't about to give up on it, though, because we don't need any more attention drawn to us. The police are bound to be there. The police always show up at the funerals of people who die in suspicious ways. It's bad enough that I've already lied to them, and that Mum did too. What are they going to think when they see her turning up dressed like she's going to a party? I followed her into the kitchen. She asked me if I wanted some tea, and I said no. I said I didn't think she should be going to the funeral at all, and she said, "Why on earth not?" "You didn't even like her," I said. "Everyone knows you didn't like her." She gave me this annoying smile and said, "Oh, they do they?" I said, "I'm going because I'm Lena's friend." And she said, "No, you're not." Dad came downstairs and said, "Don't say that, Lou. Of course he is." He said something to her really quietly so I couldn't hear, and she nodded and went upstairs. Dad made me some tea, which I didn't want, but I drank it anyway. "Will the police be there, do you think?" I asked him, even though I knew the answer.
"I expect so. Mr. Townsend knew Nell, didn't he? And, well, I imagine a number of people from the village will want to pay their respects whether they knew her or not. I know it's complicated with us, but I think it's right that we try to pull together. Don't you?"
I didn't say anything.
"And you'll want to see Lena, won't you, to tell her how sorry you are? Imagine how poor Lena must be feeling."
I still didn't say anything.
He reached out to ruffle my hair, but I ducked away from him.
"Dad," I said, "you know how the police asked about Sunday night, about where we were and all that?"
He nodded, but as he did, I saw him look over my head to check Mum wasn't listening. "You said you didn't hear anything unusual, didn't you?" he asked.
I nodded.
"You told the truth."
I wasn't sure whether he said, "You told the truth," like a question, or "You told the truth," like it was an instruction. I wanted to say something. I wanted to say it out loud. I wanted to say, what if she did something bad? Just so Dad could tell me how ridiculous I was being, so he could shout at me and say, "How could you even think that?" I said, "Mum went to the shops." He looked at me like I was thick.
"Yes, I know. She went to the shops that morning to get milk." "Josh. Oh, there you go," he said, looking over my shoulder. "There she is now. That's better, isn't it?"
she changed her red shirt to a black one. It was better, but I was still scared of what was going to happen. I was scared that she'd say something, or that she'd laugh in the middle of the ceremony or something. She had a look at that moment that was really bugging me. Not like she was happy or anything. It was more like the look she gives Dad when she wins an argument. Like when she says, "I told you it would have been quicker to take the A68. It was like she'd been proved right about something, and she couldn't get that winning look off her face. When we got to the church, there were already a lot of people milling around. That made me feel a bit better. I saw Mr. Townsend, and I think he saw me, but he didn't come over and say anything. He was just standing there, looking around. And then he stopped and watched as Lena and her aunt walked over the bridge. Lena looked really grown up, different to how she normally is. Still pretty. As she walked past us, she saw me, and she gave me a sad smile. I wanted to go over and give her a hug, but Mum was holding onto my hand really tightly so I couldn't pull away. I needn't have worried about Mum laughing. When we got into the church, she started crying, sobbing so loudly that other people turned around and looked. I wasn't sure whether that made things better or worse.
Lena. This morning I felt happy. I was lying in bed, covers thrown back. I could feel the heat of the day building, and I knew it was going to be beautiful. And I could hear Mum singing. Then I woke up. On the back of my bedroom door hung the dress I was planning to wear. It's Mum's, from Louvain. She'd never in a million years let me wear it. But today I didn't think she'd mind. It hadn't been dry cleaned since she wore it last. So it still smelled of her. When I put it on, it was like having her skin against mine. I washed and dried my hair, then tied it back. I usually wear it down, but Mum liked it up. "Totes of this," she'd say, in the way she did when she wanted me to roll my eyes at her. I wanted to go into her room to look for her bracelet. I knew it would be in there somewhere, but I couldn't do it. I haven't been able to bring myself to go into her room since she died. The last time I was in there was last Sunday afternoon. I was bored and feeling sad about Katie, so I went into her room to look for some weed. I couldn't find any in the bedside table, so I started looking through her coat pockets in the wardrobe, because sometimes she keeps stuff in there. I wasn't expecting her home. When Mum caught me, she didn't look pissed off. She just looked sort of sad.
"You can't tell me off," I said. "I'm looking for shit in your room, so you can't get pissed off with me. That would make you a total hypocrite."
"No," she said. "That would make me a grown-up." "Same thing," I said. And she laughed.
"Yeah, maybe. But the fact is that I'm allowed to smoke weed and drink alcohol, and you are not. Why are you looking to get wasted in the middle of a Sunday afternoon anyway? On your own? Kind of sad, isn't it?" Then she went on. "Why don't you go for a swim or something? Call a friend." I lost it with her, because it sounded like she was saying the kind of thing that Tanya and Ellie and all those bitches say about me. That I'm sad. That I'm a loser. That I've got no friends now, the only person who ever liked me topped herself. I started yelling.
"What fucking friend? I don't have any! Don't you remember? Don't you remember what happened to my best friend?"
She went really quiet and held her hands up the way she did, when she doesn't want to fight. But I didn't back off. I just wouldn't back off. I was yelling about how she was never around, how she just left me alone all the time, how she was so distant it seemed like she didn't even want me around at all. She was shaking her head, saying, "That isn't true. That isn't true," she said. "I'm sorry if I've been distracted, but there are some things going on that I can't explain. There's something I need to do, and I can't explain how difficult it is. I was cold with her.
You don't need to do anything, Mum. I swear you promised me you'd keep your mouth shut, so you don't have to do anything. Jesus, haven't you done enough already?
Leany, she was saying. Leany, please. You don't know everything. I'm the parent here. You have to trust me. I said some shitty things then, about how she'd never be much of a parent. What kind of parent has dope lying around the house and brings men home at night so that I can hear? I told her that if it had been the other way round, if it had been me who'd been in trouble, like Katie was, Louise would have known what to do. She'd have been the parent, and she'd have done something, and she'd have helped. And it was all bullshit, of course. Because I was the one who didn't want Mum to say anything. And she pointed that out, and then she said that in any case she had tried to help. And then I just started screaming at her, telling her everything was her fault. That if she went and blabbed to anyone, I would leave and never speak to her again. I said it over and over. You've done enough damage. The last thing I ever said to her was that it was her fault Katie was dead.
Jules. It was hot, the day of your funeral, heat shimmering over the water, the light too bright, the air too close, heavy with moisture. Leany and I walked to the church. She started out a few paces in front of me, and the distance between us stretched. I'm no good in heels. She is a natural. She looked very elegant, very beautiful, much older than her 15 years, in a black crepe dress with a keyhole on the bodice. We walked in silence, the river snaking muddily past us, sullen and quiet. The warm air smelled of decay. I felt afraid, as we turned the corner on the approach to the bridge, of who might be at the church. I was afraid that no one would turn up at all, and that Leany and I would be forced to sit alone with nothing but you between us. I kept my head down. I watched the road. I concentrated on putting one foot in front of the other, trying not to stumble on the uneven tarmac. My shirt, black and synthetic, with a pussy bow at the throat, wrong for the weather, clung to my lower back. My eyes began to water. No matter, I thought, if my mascara runs. People will think I've been crying. Leany still hasn't cried. Or at least she hasn't cried in front of me. Sometimes I think I hear her sobbing in the night, but she comes to breakfast clear-eyed and insouciant. She slips in and out of the house without a word. I hear her talking in a low voice in her room, but she ignores me. She shrinks from me when I approach. She snarls at my questions. She shuns my attention. She wants nothing to do with me. I remember you coming into my room after Mum died. You wanted to talk. I sent you away. Is this the same? Is she doing the same thing? I can't tell. As we approached the churchyard, I noticed a woman sitting on a bench by the side of the road, who smiled at me with rotted teeth. I thought I could hear someone laughing, but it was just you in my head. Some of the women you wrote about are buried in that churchyard. Some of your troublesome women. Were all of you troublesome? Libby was, of course. At 14 years of age, she seduced a 34-year-old man, enticed him away from his loving wife and infant child. Aided by her aunt, the hag May Seaton, and the numerous devils that they conjured, Libby cajoled poor blameless Matthew into any number of unnatural acts. Troublesome indeed. Mary Marsh was said to have performed abortions. Anne Ward was a killer. But what about you, Nell? What had you done? Who were you troubling? Libby is buried in the churchyard. You knew where she lay, her and the others. You showed me the stones, scraped away the moss so that we could read the words. You kept some of it, the moss, I mean, and you snuck into my room and put some under my pillow. Then you told me that Libby had left it there,
At night she walked the riverbank, you told me. If you listened hard enough, you could hear her calling for her aunt, for May, to come and rescue her. But May never comes. She can't. She isn't in the graveyard. After they extracted her confession, they hanged her in the town square. Her body is buried in the woods outside the churchyard walls, nails driven through her legs so that she'll never rise again. At the crest of the bridge, Lena turned just for a second to look at me. Her expression, impatience, perhaps just a hint of pity, was so like yours that I shivered. I clenched my fists together and bit my lip. I cannot be afraid of her. She's just a child. My feet hurt. I could feel the prickle of sweat at my hairline. I wanted to rip the fabric of my shirt. I wanted to rip my skin. I could see a small crowd gathered in the car park in front of the church. They were turning now, turning towards us, watching our approach. I thought about how it would feel to pitch myself over the stone walls. Terrifying, yes, but only for a short while. I could slip down into the mud and let the water close over my head. It would be such a relief to feel cold, to be unseen. Inside, Lena and I sat side by side, a foot apart, in the front pew. The church was full. Somewhere behind us, a woman sobbed on and on, as though her heart were broken. The vicar talked about your life. He listed your achievements. He spoke of your devotion to your daughter. I was mentioned in passing. I was the one who had given him the information, so I suppose I couldn't complain that his speech felt perfunctory. I could have said something myself. Perhaps I should have done. But I couldn't think how I could talk about you without betraying something, you or myself, or the truth. The service finished abruptly, and before I knew it, Lena was getting to her feet. I followed her along the aisle. The heat of attention turned towards us, somehow threatening, not heartening. I tried not to see the faces around me, but I couldn't help myself. The crying woman, her face crumpled and red. Sean Townsend, his eyes meeting mine. A young man with head bowed. A teenager laughing behind his fist. A violent man. I stopped suddenly, and the woman behind me stepped on my heel. "Sorry, sorry," she muttered, manoeuvring past. I didn't move, didn't breathe, couldn't swallow, my insides turning to liquid. It was him. Older, yes, uglier, gone to seed, but unmistakable. A violent man. I waited for him to turn his eyes to me. I thought that if he did, one of two things would happen. I would cry, or I would lunge at him. I waited, but he wasn't looking at me. He was looking at Lena, watching her intently. My liquid insides turned to ice. I followed blindly, pushing people out of my way. He stood to one side, his eyes still trained on Lena. He was watching her take off her shoes. Men watch girls who look like Lena in all sorts of ways. Desire, hunger, distaste. I couldn't see his eyes, but I didn't need to. I knew what was in them. I started towards him, a noise rising in my throat. People were looking at me, with pity or confusion. I didn't care. I needed to get to him. And then he turned abruptly and walked away. He walked quickly down the pathway and out into the car park, and I stood, breath suddenly rushing to my lungs, adrenaline making my head swim. He climbed into a large green car and was gone. "Jules, are you all right?" D.S. Morgan appeared at my side and placed a hand on my arm. "Did you see that man?" I asked her. "Did you see him?" "Which man?" she said, looking around her. "Who?" "He's a violent man," I said. She looked alarmed. "Where, Jules? Did someone do something? Say something to you?" "No, I... no." "Which man, Jules? Who are you talking about? My tongue was tied in reeds, and my mouth was full of mud. I wanted to tell her. I wanted to say, I remember him. I know what he's capable of. Who did you see? She asked me. Robbie, I said his name at last. Robbie Cannon. August 1993. Jules. I'd forgotten. Before the football game, something else happened. I was sitting on my towel, reading my book, no one else yet around, and then you came. You and Robbie. You didn't see me under the trees. You ran into the water with him after you, and you swam and splashed and kissed. He took your hand and pulled you to the water's edge. He lay on top of you, pushed your shoulders down, arched his back, and looked up. And saw me, watching. And smiled. Later that afternoon, I returned to the house alone. I took off the gingham bathing suit and the denim shorts, and left them soaking in cold water in the sink. I ran myself a bath, and climbed in and sank down and thought, I will never be rid of it, all this awful flesh. A big girl, a bruiser, legs to kickstart a 747. She could play front row for England. Too big for the spaces I inhabited, always overflowing. I took up too much room. I sank down into the bath, and the water rose. Eureka. Back in my room, I climbed under the bed covers and lay there, suffocating with misery, self-pity mingled with guilt, because my mother lay in bed in the very next room, and she was dying of breast cancer, and all I could think about was how much I didn't want to go on, didn't want to live like this. I fell asleep. My father woke me. He had to take my mother to the hospital for more tests, and they were going to stay the night in town, because it would be an early start. There was some supper in the oven, he said. I was to help myself. Nell was at home, I knew, because I could hear her music in the room next door. After a while, the music stopped, and then I could hear voices, low and then louder, and other noises too, moaning, grunting, a sharp intake of breath. I got out of bed, got dressed, and went out into the corridor. The light was on, the door to Nell's room slightly ajar. It was darker in there, but I could hear her. She was saying something. She was saying his name. Barely daring to breathe, I took a step closer. Through the crack in the door, I could make out their shapes moving in the darkness. I couldn't bring myself to look away. I watched until I heard him make a loud animal noise. Then he started laughing, and I knew that they were finished. Downstairs, all the lights were on. I walked around turning them off, then wandered into the kitchen and opened the fridge. I stared at its contents, and out of the corner of my eye noticed a bottle of vodka, opened, half full, on the counter. I copied what I'd seen Nell do. I poured myself half a glass of orange juice and topped it up with vodka, and then, steeling myself for the nasty, bitter, alcoholic taste I'd experienced from trying wine and beer, I took a sip and found that it was sweet, not bitter at all. I finished the drink and poured another. I enjoyed the physical sensation, the warmth spreading from my stomach into my chest, my blood heating up, my whole body loosening, that afternoon's misery ebbing away. I went into the living room and looked out at the river, a slick black snake running underneath the house. It was surprising to me how suddenly I could see what I hadn't before, that the problem of me was not insurmountable at all. I had a sudden moment of clarity. I didn't have to be fixed. I could be fluid, like the river. Perhaps it wouldn't be so difficult after all. Wasn't it possible to starve myself, to move more, in secret when no one was watching, to be transformed, caterpillar into butterfly, to become a different person, unrecognizable, so that the ugly, bleeding girl would be forgotten. I would be made new. I went back to the kitchen to get some more to drink. I heard footsteps upstairs, padding along the landing, and then coming down the stairs. I slipped back into the living room, turned off the lamp, and crouched in the darkness on the window seat, my feet pulled up beneath me. I saw him go into the kitchen, heard him opening the fridge, no, the freezer. I could hear him cracking ice out of the trays. I heard the glug of liquid, and then I saw him as he walked past. And then he stopped, and took a step back. Julia, is that you? I didn't say anything. Didn't breathe. I didn't want to see anyone. I certainly didn't want to see him. But he was fumbling for the light switch, and then the lights came on, and there he stood, in boxer shorts and nothing else, his skin a deep tan, his shoulders wide, body tapering to a tight waist, the fuzz on his stomach leading down into his shorts. He smiled at me. "Are you okay?" he asked. As he stepped closer, I could see that his eyes looked a little glazed, his grin stupider, lazier than usual. "Why are you sitting here in the dark?" He caught sight of my glass, and the smile grew wider. "I thought the vodka was looking low." He walked over to me and clinked his glass against mine, then sat down at my side, his thigh pressed against my foot. I moved away, put my feet on the floor, and started to get up, but he put his hand on my arm. "Hey, wait," he said. "Don't run off. I want to talk to you. I wanted to apologize for this afternoon." "That's okay," I said. I could feel my face reddening. I didn't look at him. "No, I'm sorry. Those guys were being dickheads. I'm really sorry, okay?" I nodded. "It's nothing to be ashamed of." I cringed. My whole body burned with the shame of it. Some small, stupid part of me had hoped they hadn't seen, hadn't realized what it was. He squeezed my arm, narrowing his eyes as he looked at me. "You've got a pretty face, Julia, you know that?" He laughed. "I mean it, you have." He released my arm, slung his own around my shoulders. "Where's Nell?" I asked. "Sleeping," he said. He sipped his drink and smacked his lips. "Think I wore her out?" He pulled my body closer to his. "Have you ever kissed a guy before, Julia?" he asked me. "Do you want to kiss me?" He turned my face to his and put his lips against mine. I felt his tongue, hot and slimy, pushing into my mouth. I thought I might gag, but I let him do it, just to see what it was like. When I pulled away, he smiled at me. "You like that?" he asked, hot breath, stale smoke and alcohol in my face. He kissed me again, and I kissed him back, trying to feel whatever it was I was supposed to be feeling. His hand slid into the waistband of my pajama bottoms. I wriggled away, mortified, as I felt his fingers pushing against the fat of my belly, into my knickers. "No!" I thought I'd cried out, but it was more like a whisper. "It's okay," he said. "Don't worry. I don't mind a bit of blood." He got angry with me afterwards, because I wouldn't stop crying. "Oh, come on. It didn't hurt that much. Don't cry. Come on, Julia, stop crying. Didn't you think it was nice? It was good. How it felt, wasn't it? You were wet enough. Come on, Julia. Have another drink. There you go. Have a sip. Jesus Christ, stop crying. Fuck's sake. I thought you'd be grateful."
2015. Sean. I drove Helen and me father home, but when we got to the front door, I was reluctant to cross the threshold. Occasionally, strange thoughts take hold of me,
and I struggled to shake them off. I stood outside the house, my wife and father inside, looking back at me expectantly. I told them to eat without me. I said I needed to go back to the station. I am a coward. I owe my father more than this. I should be with him today. Today of all days. Helen will help him, of course, but even she cannot understand how he will be feeling, the depth of his suffering. And yet I couldn't sit with him. I couldn't meet his eye. Somehow, he and I can never look each other in the eye when our minds are on my mother. I took the car and drove not to the station, but back to the churchyard. My mother was cremated. She isn't here. My father took her ashes to a special place. He never told me where exactly, although he did promise that one day he'd take me. We never went. I used to ask about it, but it always upset him, so after a while I let it be. The church and graveyard were deserted, no one in sight except for old Nicky Sage, hobbling slowly around outside. I left the car, taking the path around the stone wall towards the trees behind the church. When I reached Nicky, she was standing with one hand on the wall, breath whistling in her chest. She turned suddenly. Her face was a florid pink, and she was sweating profusely.
"What do you want?"
she wheezed.
"Why are you following me?"
I smiled. "I'm not following you. I spotted you from my car, and I just thought I'd come over and say hello. Are you all right?"
"I'm fine. I'm fine."
She didn't look fine. She leaned against the wall and looked up at the sky.
"There'll be a storm later."
I nodded. "Smells like it." She jerked her head back.
"Is that all done, then, Nell Abbott? Closing the file? Consigning her to history?"
The case isn't closed," I said.
"Not yet. We'll be soon, though, won't it?"
She muttered something else under her breath. "What was that?"
"It's all sewn up, isn't it?"
She turned to face me full on and prodded me in the chest with a fat forefinger.
"You know, don't you, that this wasn't like the last one? This wasn't like Katie Whittaker. This was like your mother."
I took a step backwards. "What is that supposed to mean?" I asked her. "If you know something, you should tell me. Do you? Do you know something about Nell Abbott's death?" She turned away, muttering again, her words indistinguishable. My breath quickened, my body flushed with heat. "Don't mention my mother to me like that. Today of all days, Christ, what sort of a person does that?" She waved a hand at me.
"Oh, you don't listen. You lot never listen," she said,
and tottered off down the path, still talking as she went, every now and again reaching out to the stone wall to steady herself. I was angry with her, but more than that. I felt blindsided, wounded almost. We'd known each other for years, and I'd never been anything but polite to her. She was misguided, sure, but I didn't think of her as a bad person, and I certainly never thought of her as cruel. I trudged back towards the car before changing my mind and veering off to the village shop. I bought a bottle of Talisker. My father likes it, though he doesn't drink a great deal. I thought we could share a glass together later, to make up for before, for my leaving like that. I tried to picture it, the two of us sitting at the kitchen table, the bottle between us, raising a glass. I wondered what, who we would raise it to. The mere imagining of it made me fearful, and my hand started to shake. I opened the bottle. The smell of the whiskey and the heat of the alcohol in my chest brought to mind childhood fevers, fraught dreams. Waking with my mother sitting on the edge of my bed, pushing damp hair from my forehead, rubbing Vicks into my chest. There have been times in my life when I've barely thought of her at all, but lately she has been in my thoughts more and more than ever over the past few days. Her face comes to me. Sometimes she's smiling, sometimes not. Sometimes she reaches for me. The summer storm started without me noticing. Perhaps I dropped off. I only know that when I came to, the road ahead looked like a river and thunder seemed to shake the car. I turned the key in the ignition, but then it struck me that the whiskey bottle in my lap was only 2/3 full, so I switched the engine off again. Under the drum of thunderous rain, I could hear my breathing, and just for a moment, I thought I could hear someone else's breath too. I was struck by the ridiculous notion that if I turned around, there would be someone there on the back seat of the car. For a moment, I was so sure of this that I was too afraid to move. I decided a walk in the rain would sober me up. I opened the car door, checking the back seat despite myself, and stepped out. I was instantly soaked through and blinded by water. A fork of lightning split the air, and in that second, I saw Julia, drenched, half walking, half running towards the bridge. I slid back into the car and flashed the lights on and off. She stopped. I flashed the lights again, and tentatively, she made her way towards me. She stopped a few meters away. I wound down the window and called out to her. She opened the door and got in. She was still wearing her funeral clothes, though they were sodden now and clinging to a small frame. She changed her shoes, though. I noticed that her tights had laddered. I could see a small circle of pale flesh on her knee. It seemed shocking, because whenever I've seen her before, her body has always been covered, long sleeves and high collars, no skin on show. Unreachable. "What are you doing out here?" I asked. She glanced down at the whiskey in my lap, but made no comment. Instead, she reached over, pulled my face to hers, and kissed me. It was strange, heady. I could taste blood on her tongue, and for a second I succumbed before pulling violently away from her. "I'm sorry," she said, wiping her lips, her eyes cast down. "I'm so sorry. I've no idea why I did that." "No," I said, "neither do I." Incongruously, we both started to laugh, nervously at first, and then wholeheartedly, as though the kiss were the most hilarious joke in the world. When we stopped, we were both wiping tears from our faces. "What are you doing out here, Julia?" "Jules," she said. "I was looking for Lena. I'm not sure where she is." She looked different to me, no longer closed off. "I'm frightened," she said, and she laughed again, as though embarrassed now. "I'm really frightened." "Frightened of what?" She cleared her throat and pushed her wet hair back from her face. "What are you afraid of?" She took a deep breath. "I don't... This sounds strange, I know, but there was a man at the funeral, a man I recognized. He used to be Nell's boyfriend."
"Oh?
I mean, not recently, forever ago, when we were teenagers. I've no idea if she'd seen him more recently than that." There were two high spots of color in her cheeks. She never mentioned him in any of her phone messages, but he was there at the funeral, and I can't explain why. But I think he might have done something to her."
"Done something? You're saying you think he might have been involved in a death?"
She looked at me imploringly.
"I can't say that, of course, but you need to look into him. You need to find out where he was when she died."
My scalp shriveled, adrenaline cutting through the alcohol. "What's this man's name? Who are you talking about?"
"Robbie Cannon."
I drew a blank for a moment, but then it came to me.
"Cannon? Logo guy? The family had car dealerships, a lot of money. That one?"
"Yes, that one.
You know him?"
"I don't know him, but I remember him."
"You remember?"
"From school. He was in the year above. Good at sport. Did well with girls. Not very bright." Her head bent so that her chin almost touched her chest. Jules said,
"I didn't know you were at school here."
"Yes," I said. "I've always lived here. You wouldn't remember me, but I remember you. You and your sister, of course.
Oh, she said, and her face closed like a shutter slamming shut. She put her hand on the door handle, as though making to leave.
Hang on, I said. What makes you think Cannon did something to your sister? Did he say something? Do something? Was he violent towards her?
Julia shook her head and looked away. I just know that he's dangerous. He's not a good person. And I saw him looking at Lena.
Looking at her?
Yes, looking.
She turned her head and met my eye at last.
I didn't like the way he looked at her.
Okay, I said. I'll see what I can find out.
Thank you.
She made to open the car door again, but I put my hand on her arm. I'll drive you back, I said. Again, a glance at the bottle, but no word.
Okay.
It took just a couple of minutes to get back to the mill house, and neither of us spoke until Jules had opened the car door. I shouldn't have said anything, but I wanted to tell her.
You're very likely, you know.
She looked shocked and gave a startled, hiccuping laugh.
I'm nothing at all like her.
She brushed a tear from her cheek.
I'm the auntie, Nell.
I don't think so, I said. But she was already gone. I don't remember driving home.
The Drowning Pool. Lauren. 1983. For Lauren's 32nd birthday, in a week's time, they would go to Craster. Just her and Sean, because Patrick would be working. It's my favourite place in all the world, she told her son. There's a castle and a beautiful beach, and sometimes you can see seals on the rocks. And after we've been to the beach and the castle, we'll go to the smokehouse and eat kippers on brown bread. Heaven! Sean wrinkled his nose. I think I'd rather go to London, he announced. To see the tower, and have ice creams. His mother laughed and said, Okay then, perhaps we could do that instead. In the end, they didn't do either. It was November, the days short and bitter, and Lauren was distracted. She was aware that she was acting differently, but couldn't seem to stop. She found herself sitting at the breakfast table with her family, and all of a sudden her skin would flush, her face would burn, and she would have to turn away to hide it. She turned away when her husband came to kiss her, too. The movement of her head was almost involuntary, beyond her control, so that his lips brushed her cheek or the corner of her mouth. 3 days before her birthday, there was a storm. It built all day, a vicious wind ripping down the valley, white horses riding the breadth of the pool. At night, the storm broke, the river pushing at its banks, trees felled along its length. The rain came down in sheets, the whole world under water. Lauren's husband and son slept like babies, but Lauren was awake. In the study downstairs, she sat at her husband's desk, a bottle of his favoured scotch at her elbow. She drank a glass and tore a sheet of paper from a notebook. She drank another glass, and another, and the page remained blank. She couldn't even decide on a form of address. Dear seemed dismissive, and dearest a lie. With the bottle almost empty and the page still unmarked, she walked out into the storm. Her blood thick with drink and grief and anger, she made her way to the pool. The village was empty, hatches battened down. Unseen and undisturbed, she clambered and slipped through mud to the cliff. She waited. She waited for someone to come. She prayed that the man she had fallen in love with might miraculously somehow know, might somehow sense her despair and come to save her from herself. But the voice she heard, calling her name in panicked desperation, was not the one she wanted to hear. And so boldly she stepped up to the precipice and, eyes wide open, pitched herself forward. There was no way she could have seen him, no way she could have known that her boy was down there, behind the tree line. No way she could have known that he had been woken by his father's shouts and the sound of the front door slamming, that he had got up and run downstairs and out into the storm, his feet bare and his skinny limbs covered only by the thinnest cotton. Sean saw his father climbing into the car and screamed for his mother. Patrick turned, yelling at his son to go back into the house. He ran towards him, grabbing him roughly by the arm and yanking him off his feet, and tried to force him back into the house. But the boy begged, "Please, please don't leave me here." Patrick relented. He gathered the boy up and carried him to the car, securing him in the back seat, where Sean cowered, terrified and uncomprehending. He squeezed his eyes tightly shut. They drove to the river. His father parked the car up on the bridge and said to him, "Wait, wait here." But it was dark, and the rain on the roof of the car sounded like bullets, and Sean couldn't escape the feeling that there was someone else in the car with him. He could hear their ragged breathing. So he got out and ran, tripping down the stone steps and falling in the mud on the path, blundering in the darkness and the rain towards the pool. There was a story, later, at school, that he saw it. He was the boy who watched his mother jump to her death. It wasn't true. He didn't see anything. When he got to the pool, his father was already in the water, swimming out. He didn't know what to do, so he went back and sat under the trees, his back to a stout trunk so that no one could sneak up on him. It seemed as though he was there for a very long time. Thinking back, he wondered if he might even have fallen asleep, although with the darkness and the noise and the fear, that didn't seem terribly likely. What he could remember was a woman coming. Jeannie, from the police station. She had a blanket and a torch, and she took him back up to the bridge and gave him sweet tea to drink, and they waited there for his father. Later, Jeannie drove him to her house and made him cheese on toast. But there was no way Lauren could have known any of that.
Erin. Leaving the funeral, I noticed how many people who had attended the service made their way over to say a few words to Sean Townsend's father, a man I had been introduced to, incredibly briefly, as Patrick Townsend. There was much shaking of hands and doffing of caps, and all the while he stood there like a major general on parade, back straight and lips stiff. "Miserable bugger, isn't he?" I said to the uniform standing next to me. The PC turned and looked at me like I had just crawled out from under a rock.
"Show some respect,"
he hissed and turned his back on me.
"Excuse me?"
I said, talking to the scruff of his neck.
"He's a highly decorated officer,"
the PC said,
"and a widower. His wife died here in this river."
He turned again to face me, and without a hint of deference to my position, he sniffed,
"So you ought to show some respect."
I felt like a fucking idiot.
But really, how was I supposed to know that the Sean and Nell Abbott story was the Sean in the police station? I didn't know his parents' names. Fuck's sake. Nobody told me. And when I read through Nell Abbott's work, it wasn't like I was paying that much attention to the details of a suicide that took place more than 3 decades ago. It didn't seem overly pressing under the circumstances. Seriously, how is anyone supposed to keep track of all the bodies around here? It's like Midsummer Murders, only with accidents and suicides and grotesque historical misogynistic drownings instead of people falling into the slurry or bashing each other over the head. I drove back to the city after work. Some of the others were going to the pub, but thanks to the Patrick Townsend faux pas, I was wearing my outsider status a little more heavily than before. In any event, this case is over, isn't it? No point hanging around. I felt relieved. The way you do when you finally figure out what movie you've seen an actor in before. When something hazy that's been bothering you suddenly snaps into focus. The D.I.'s strangeness, the watery eyes, the shaky hands, his disconnectedness. It all makes sense now. It makes sense if you know his history. His family has suffered almost exactly what Jules and Lena are suffering now. The same horror, the same shock, the same wondering why. I reread Nell Abbott's section on Lauren Townsend. It doesn't tell much of a story. She was an unhappy wife in love with another man. It talks of her distraction, her absence. Maybe she was depressed. In the end, who knows? It's not like this stuff is gospel. It's just Nell Abbott's version of history. It must take a strange sense of entitlement, I would have thought, to take someone else's tragedy like that and write it as though it belonged to you. Rereading it, the thing I don't understand is how Sean could have stayed here. Even if he didn't see her fall, he was there. What the fuck does that do to you? Still, it would have been small, I suppose. 6 or 7. Kids can block it out, trauma like that. But the father? He walks by the river every day. I've seen him. Imagine that. Imagine walking past the place where you lost someone every single day. I can't credit it. Couldn't do it. But then I suppose I've never really lost anyone. How would I know what that kind of grief feels like?
Part 2. Tuesday, the 18th of August. Louise. Louise's grief was like the river, constant and ever-changing. It rippled, flooded, ebbed and flowed, some days cold and dark and deep, some days swift and blinding. Her guilt was liquid too. It seeped through cracks when she tried to dam it out. She had good days and bad. Yesterday, she had gone to the church to watch them put Nell in the ground. In reality, and she ought to have known this, they didn't. Still, she got to watch her slide away to burn, so that was what passed for a good day. Even the outpouring of emotion, she had sobbed throughout the ceremony, despite herself, was cathartic. But today was going to be a bitch. She felt it when she woke, not a presence but an absence. The elation she'd felt at first, her vengeful satisfaction, was already waning. And now, with Nell burned to ashes, Louise was left with nothing. Nothing. At no one's door could she lay her pain and suffering, because Nell was gone. And she worried that in the end the only place she had to bring her torment was home. Home to her husband and son. So, today was going to be a bitch, but that bitch had to be faced, stared down. She had made up her mind. It was time to move on. They needed to go before it was too late. Louise and her husband Alec had been arguing about this, the sort of low-level, quiet arguments they had these days, for weeks. Alec felt it would be better to move before the new school term started. They should let Josh start the new school year in a completely new place, he argued, when no one knew who he was, where he wouldn't be confronted with his sister's absence every day. "So he'll never have to talk about her?" Louise asked. "He'll talk about her with us," Alec replied. They'd been standing in the kitchen, their voices strained and hushed. "We need to sell this house and start over," Alec said. "I know," he said, raising his hands as Louise began to protest. "I know this is her home." He faltered then, placing his big hands, mottled with sun damage, on the counter. He hung on as if for dear life. "We have to make some kind of new start, Lou, for Josh. If it were just you and me..." If it were just them, she thought, they'd follow Katie into the water and be done with it, wouldn't they? She wasn't sure Alec would. She used to think that only parents can understand the sort of love that swallows you up. But now she wondered whether it was only mothers who did. Alec felt the grief, of course, but she wasn't sure he felt the despair or the hatred. So the fault lines were already beginning to show in a marriage she'd thought unshakable. But of course she'd known nothing before. Now it was obvious. No marriage could survive this loss. It would always sit between them, that neither of them had been able to stop her. Worse, that neither of them had suspected a thing. That the two of them had gone to bed and fallen asleep and discovered her empty bed in the morning and had not for a single second imagined she'd be in the river. There was no hope for Louise, and little, she thought, for Alec. But Josh was different. Josh would miss his sister every day for the rest of his life, but he could be happy. He would. He would carry her with him, but he would also work, travel, fall in love, live. And the best chance he had was to be away from here, away from Beckford, away from the river. Louise knew that her husband was right about that. Somewhere inside, she'd known this already. She'd just been reluctant to face it. But yesterday, watching her son after the funeral, she had been gripped by terror. His pinched, anxious face. How easily he startled, flinching at loud noises, cowering like a frightened dog in a crowd. The way he constantly turned his gaze to her, as though he was retreating back into early childhood, no longer an independent 12-year-old, but a frightened, needy little boy. They had to get him away from here. And yet, this was where Katie had taken her first steps, spoken her first words, played hide-and-seek, cartwheeled around the garden, fought with her little brother, soothed him afterwards, laughed and sung and cried and cursed and bled and hugged her mum every day when she got home from school. But Louise had made up her mind. Like her daughter, she was determined, although the effort was immense. Just to get up from the kitchen table, walk to the bottom of the stairs and then climb them, to place her hand on the door handle, to push down, to enter her room for the last time. Because that's what it felt like. This was the last time it would be her room. After today, it would be something else. Louise's heart was a block of wood. It didn't beat, it only pained her, scraping against soft tissue, tearing through vein and muscle, flooding her chest with blood. Good days and bad. She couldn't leave the room like this. Hard as it was to think about packing up Katie's things, putting away her clothes, taking her pictures down from the walls, tidying her away, hiding her from view, it was worse to think of strangers in here. It was worse to imagine what they would touch, how they would look for clues, how they would marvel at how normal everything looked, how normal Katie had looked. Her? Surely not. Surely she can't be the one who drowned. So Louise would do it. She would clear the school things from the desk and pick up the pen that once rested in her daughter's fist. She would fold up the soft grey T-shirt that Katie slept in. She would make her bed. She would take the blue earrings that Katie's favourite aunt had given her for her 14th birthday and tidy them away into her jewellery box. She would take the big, black suitcase from the top of the cupboard in the hallway. She would fill it with Katie's clothes. She would. She was standing in the middle of the room, thinking all this, when she heard a noise behind her, and she turned to see Josh standing in the doorway, watching her. "Mom?" He was white as a ghost, his voice caught in his throat. "What are you doing?" "Nothing, darling, I'm just..." She took a step towards him, but he stepped back.